This is Functional Medicine Update for May 2007, Volume 27, Number 5. Our subject of discussion this month is brain dysfunction. We'll be talking about the complex web of behavioral neurology, and we'll review clinical markers of hyperinsulinemia insulin resistance. Also included this month, atherogenic dysplasia associated with metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance, and cardiometabolic syndrome, a new term in defining non-traditional risk factors for cardiovascular disease. Our interview is with Dr. Jay Lombard, discussing functional neurology. Now here's Dr. Jeffrey Bland.
Welcome to May 2007 Functional Medicine Update. You know, we had the decade of the brain in the 1990s, but certainly we're learning much more as to what brain dysfunction originates from, and we see it as really a functional medicine problem. When we talk about hyperactivity attention disorders, or we talk about autism, or we talk about the nature of depression, dysphoria, or non-Alzheimer's dementia, cognitive dysfunction, we're talking about web of dysfunction that not only is isolated in the brain in and of itself, but is signaled through much of the body, through gut, through immune system, through hepatic function, through vascular function. And it's the interaction of those systems together in this functional web that gives rise to what we call behavioral neurological problems. There's even the environment and the perception of the environment itself, these epigenetic effects that occur through the process of modifying kinases and gene expression and signaling pathways. So we might have traumatic life experiences, post-traumatic stress syndrome, violence, rejection, the feeling of no attribution, no love. These are also translated through same receptor sites and same signal transduction pathways to give rise to an amplified effect on the neuroimmune system that we see as behavioral neurological problems. So it's this very complex web that ultimately gives rise to the challenge individuals have in trying to figure out therapeutic approaches towards neurological difficulties, because it's more than just a single path to enlightenment. It's more than just one agent causes one disease. It is truly the application of functional medicine that will help us to unravel and tease apart the multiple etiological factors that contribute to these dysfunctions that we ultimately give ICD-9 codes, diagnostic codes to, as if they were single, independent, isolated diseases. Well, there's no better example of that, I think, than the emerging story that surrounds metabolic syndrome and its relationship to cognitive decline and what we often call non-Alzheimer's or even Alzheimer's-like dementia. This was first brought to much of the medical world's mind in 2004 when the article entitled The Metabolic Syndrome, Inflammation and the Risk of Cognitive Decline was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in the November 10, 2004 issue, volume 292, page 2237. The investigators headed by Christine Yaffe and Ann Newman, this is the Department of Psychiatry and Neurology and Epidemiology, as well as Geriatrics, the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, and also the National Institutes of Aging in Baltimore, Maryland. This collaborative study looked at the effect of a 5-year prospective observational evaluation conducted from 1997 to 2002 at community clinics at two sites, totaling 2,632 black and white elders, mean age 74 years, and trying to tease apart whether there was an association between metabolic syndrome or insulin resistance hyperinsulinemia and that related to loss of cognitive function. You probably recall the conclusion of the study, which was quite dramatic for many individuals who were unaware of this connection between insulin resistance and inflammation and brain function, because the findings of the study support the hypothesis that metabolic syndrome contributes significantly to cognitive impairment in elders, primarily in those with very high levels of inflammation as measured by increased levels of high-sensitivity C-reactive protein above 1 gram per liter. So these particular associations of elevation in inflammatory markers associated with metabolic syndrome and then cognitive decline started the research world moving at a faster pace, trying to understand the mechanisms by which this could occur. So the first question that is raised, obviously, is what role would high insulin have on neurological function and inflammation? Because it's not an obvious connection in that we think that the brain is not an insulin-requiring organ. It's insulin-independent for its glucose utilization. So we would say, I don't understand exactly what role insulin would be having. Yet it is now recognized that neurons have insulin receptor sites and that insulin activates at high levels of signal transduction NF-kappa-B transcription. And as you probably know, NF-kappa-B plays an important role in ultimately stimulating gene expression of pro-inflammatory cytokines like tumor necrosis factor alpha and interleukin-6. This has been obviously published in many different papers, but a couple of interesting review papers are that of Benoli et al. In Journal of Cellular Science in 1997, actually, where this was first reported, volume 110, page 2089. We know that this hyperinsulinemia connection to inflammation is emerging to be a very well-understood gene expression outcome from high levels of insulin signaling. Studies implicate an inflammatory process in the pathogenesis of insulin resistance associated with many disorders, including central obesity with increased visceral adipose tissue accumulation and in type 2 diabetes as well, and identify the fact that as you have high levels of insulin, there is an activation of inhibitor kappa kinase beta, which then phosphorylates inhibitor kappa B, causing that to disassociate from the NF-kappa B complex, allowing NF-kappa B then to gain access to the genome where it sits down in specific portions of your book of life on your genes and causes them to be read. And these stories that are read are the pro-inflammatory cytokines, and including also the cyclooxygenase enzymes and the production of pro-inflammatory prostaglandins. So it turns out that insulin plays a very important role in modulating or mediating these immunological effects. We know that data has shown that mononuclear cells are able to be activated into a pro-inflammatory state with an increase in NF-kappa-B binding, and that plasma high levels of free fatty acids can activate the mononuclear cells to produce more pro-inflammatory mediators. And high levels of free fatty acids are associated with metabolic syndrome and hyperinsulinemia. And insulin resistance is a function of inflammatory mediators. A number of papers have been published demonstrating this, including one paper discussing circulating mononuclear cells and the pro-inflammatory condition associated with hyperinsulinemia. This is in Circulation, Volume 110, page 1564 in 2004. So we know that high levels of free fatty acids associated with hyperinsulinemia can result in lipid accumulation in tissues, such as the liver and in muscle, and this can lead to localized tissue inflammatory signaling that causes apoptosis of cells in those tissues and loss of cell mass, like in the liver, leading to hepatic inflammation through NF-kappa-B activation. Similarly, in the brain, we don't think of the brain becoming engorged with fat. It's not a tissue that we normally would talk about accumulation of triglycerides. But the same process of high levels of fatty acids that initiates then the triggering of the pro-inflammatory mediators can have an effect across the blood-brain barrier and increase then a neuronal inflammatory response. So it's both the direct effects of insulin and the indirect effects through the inflammatory pathways that may associate itself then between the hyperinsulinemic states and metabolic syndrome and cognitive decline. More recently, as you probably know, as published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in volume 292, page 114 in 2006, was the very nice review entitled Insulin Effects Weigh Heavy on the Brain. As you know, this article review went on to talk about the best known role for regulator of blood glucose and fatty acid storage is insulin, but insulin also acts in the brain, as we said, to aid memory and thinking. When insulin regulation is disrupted, as it is in many common medical conditions, including diabetes, the risk for cognitive impairment rises. Insulin dysregulation sets the stage for certain neurodegenerative disorders, particularly various forms of Alzheimer's disease, as was discovered by Dr. Suzanne Kraft, professor of psychiatry at the University of Washington, Seattle. Kraft and her colleagues have been studying, you probably recognize this, the link between insulin and memory for the past decade, and their research is suggesting potential approaches to treat, delay, or even protect against Alzheimer's disease associated with hyperinsulinemia and altered insulin signaling. We recognize that in normal physiology and also when insulin is administered peripherally at optimal doses, insulin can enhance memory. However, Kraft's team has found evidence that hyperinsulinemia is associated with inflammation in the brain and triggers the accumulation of the 42-peptide form of beta amyloid, the precursor of amyloid plaques that are found in certain brain regions and, as you know, are a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. This was published in Archives in Neurology in Volume 62, page 1539 in 2005. So there's now evidence implicating insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, and inflammation as risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, and the high level of insulin seems to boost beta amyloid levels and induce then this inflammatory state. This has become so well recognized that recently in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, an article was published entitled Impaired Insulin and Insulin-like Growth Factor Expression and Signaling Mechanisms in Alzheimer's Disease. Is this type 3 diabetes? Question mark. So now they're actually even starting to provide a kind of a name for this condition of hyperinsulinemia associated with Alzheimer's disease and loss of cognitive function as a type 3 diabetes. In fact, in this article, they go on to say that the strikingly reduced central nervous system expression of genes encoding insulin, insulin-like growth factor 1 and insulin-like growth factor 1 receptor, as well as the insulin and IGF-1 receptors, suggests that Alzheimer's disease may represent actually a neuroendocrine disorder that resembles yet is distinct from diabetes and therefore might be termed type 3 diabetes. This is the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, Volume 5, page 43 in 2005. So how does one clinically evaluate the relative risk to cognitive decline and memory problems that are associated with insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia? And, you know, we've thought in the past that we were just doing this evaluation to look for the potential risk to type 2 diabetes. Now we're looking at the risk to potential neurological dysfunction and also to cardiac disease as well. So let's just do a quick review of the kind of clinical markers that we think are important for evaluating the relative risk of a patient having hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance. First of all, elevated serum triglycerides, generally greater than 130 milligram per deciliter. We might put under that another clinical parameter that's not normally measured, but maybe even has a higher clinical specificity to metabolic syndrome, and that's high serum free fatty acid levels. Free fatty acids, as you know, are the debris or the breakdown products of triglycerides. When triglyceride lipase, an enzyme that's present in plasma, operates on triglycerides, it liberates free fatty acids. This condition of high free fatty acids is tightly related to hyperinsulinemia and metabolic syndrome, even more so than that of serum triglycerides, although we would say fasting elevation of serum triglycerides is a good surrogate marker. Second evaluative tool that is commonly used for evaluating the presence of metabolic syndrome is depressed high-density lipoprotein cholesterol or lowered HDL levels. These would be males less than 40, females less than 50. Now, that would beg the question, what then about the ratio of triglycerides to HDL? We associate metabolic syndrome with elevated triglycerides and reduced HDL, then wouldn't the ratio of triglyceride to HDL even be a more sensitive marker? And that seems to be yes to that particular question. With serum triglyceride HDL ratios greater than 4 to 1, you have increasing relative presence of insulin resistance. If you were to do euglycemic insulin clamp experiments on that person with an elevated triglyceride HDL ratio, you would undoubtedly find that they had insulin resistance. So, again, the ratio of serum triglyceride HDL when greater than 4 to 1 and with increasing levels of that ratio. So let's take an example of a person with triglycerides of 160 and an HDL of 40. That would be a 4 to 1 ratio. If it goes up to a fasting triglyceride of 200 and an HDL of 40, that's a 5 to 1 ratio. That would be more evidence of metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance. if we went to a serum fasting triglycerides of 240 and an HDL of 30, now you have an 8-to-1 ratio, and that would be even, obviously, more relative risk to metabolic syndrome and hyperinsulinemia. So the serum triglyceride HDL ratio is a reasonably good surrogate marker for metabolic syndrome insulin resistance. We've also put on the list, obviously, elevated high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, or hsCRP, greater than 0.9 to 1 a milligram per liter, is suggested to be a relative risk factor to the inflammatory component associated with metabolic syndrome. The next is hemoglobin A1c, or glycosylated hemoglobin. We recognize that glycosylated hemoglobin has a very strong correlation to poor blood sugar control in the diabetic, but it also has been found as a consequence of glycemic variability to be associated with increasing risk to hyperinsulinemia metabolic syndrome when it's marginally elevated, still within the normal range, but at the high end of normal range. In fact, it's been said that glycosylated hemoglobin is greater than 5.5% of total hemoglobin may represent independent risk factors that are associated with a metabolic syndrome. I'm now quoting from a recent paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 295, page 1707 in 2006. So marginally elevated glycosylated hemoglobins, or hemoglobin A1c, increased levels of high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, and there's a nice paper that discusses insulin resistance and its relationship to elevated CRP. This was in Metabolism and Clinical Experimental Medicine, volume 54, page 439 in 2005. Moving from that, then we get into elevated percent body fat, which is an anthropometric measurement, and as you probably know, can be done by bioimpedance analysis or hydrostatic weighing or even using the qualitative test of body mass index, ratio of height to weight ratio. Next is elevated waist to hip ratio, generally greater than one, using a tape measure basically to measure waist and hip measurements and do the ratio. And even making it more simple, we recognize that elevated waist circumference with men greater than 40 inches and women greater than 35 has a very strong correlation with metabolic syndrome. Next is elevated systolic and/or diastolic blood pressure greater than 130 over 85, another risk factor to metabolic syndrome. Elevated uric acid in fasting plasma is another indication of metabolic syndrome, hyperuricemia. And then, of course, the last one, when we start viewing cardiometabolic risks associated with metabolic syndrome, are elevated apolipoproteins. And these are the ones that are emerging maybe to have the most clinical significance of relative risk assessment in the early stage. The two that have been in the news most recently are apolipoprotein B and apolipoprotein A1 measurements. Now, I want to speak a little bit, if I can, to atherogenic dyslipidemia associated with metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance, because I think it's this new area that has really gained a lot of prominence, and we can connect then the heart to the brain, to the liver, to the pancreas through the assessment of these dyslipidemic transitions that occur with metabolic syndrome. Scott Grundy, who is a very well-known champion for the metabolic syndrome concept, professor of internal medicine and director of the Center of Human Nutrition at University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, has recently authored a very nice review in a Clinical Cornerstone entitled Dyslipidemia and Metabolic Syndrome. This is volume 8, page 21 in 2006. And he goes on to say that atherogenic dyslipidemia, a component of metabolic syndrome, is characterized by high levels of this apolipoprotein B containing lipoproteins and a reduced level of HDL lipoprotein cholesterol. Now let's just mention for review what we mean by apolipoprotein. As I'm sure you recognize, lipids, which are fats, be it triglycerides or cholesterol, are not well solubilized in water, and the blood is made principally of water, so that would be like trying to dissolve oil in water. So in order to transport these fats, which are critically important as both energy substrates and as messenger molecule precursors, as we have with cholesterol that gets converted into things like not only bile acids but hormones, there has to be a transport system, and the way that that transport system is manifest is through the body's ability to produce specific detergent-like molecules that are called apolipoproteins. Proteins are kind of like detergents. They have a non-polar component, and they have a polar head group that makes them water-soluble. So they can bind specific types of fats, just like detergent does in your washing machine, and allow them to be solubilized into the blood. Now, this process of forming these apolipoproteins is not a random process. The body just doesn't make it random different detergent molecules. It makes specific molecules to transport specific types of fats. And these apolipoproteins have names such as A, B, C, D, E, and they have different compositions. Proteins are regulated by different genetic programming, and they then trap and bind specific types of fats, cholesterol and triglycerides of different sizes and different shapes, and they then deliver them to specific receptors on the cell surface that is triggered by the unique affinity between a specific apolipoprotein and a specific cell membrane receptor site. So it's not just random delivery of fats to cells. They're delivered in a very prepackaged and pre-programmed way through the communication between the apolipoprotein and the cell surface membrane receptor. Now, this is an important concept because I think in the past it's been felt that fats are the cause of heart disease. When we have fats in the blood, that somehow they glomp on to the artery wall and they produce these plaques, like just depositing like grease on the side of a vessel, like debris. But that's actually not the process of atherogenesis. It's much more specific, related to intracellular communication between agents that are in the outside environment that get translated into the interior of the cells that make up the various layers within the artery wall that initiate then injury to the artery and are associated with what is called atherogenesis. And these apolipoproteins are able to deliver different messages to the artery wall cells, the vascular endothelium, and even into the internal portions of the vascular wall. So apolipoprotein physiology may be as important as the amount of fats that are floating around in your blood. And the composition and communication of these apolipoproteins is very strictly regulated by environmental factors that cause the synthesis of these apolipoproteins to be made in response to the signals that are present in the body. So it could be hormones that initiate this. One of the hormones, obviously, is insulin. Could be sex steroid hormones, however, like testosterone, androgens, and progesterone, and also estrogens. They influence the synthesis of specific types of apolipoproteins. We also know that the environmental factors such as stress can modulate apolipoprotein. So here we get into behavioral neurology and behavioral cardiology, in which we start seeing how we think about our environment may influence then how our body synthesizes these specific transport proteins that ultimately deliver different messages and fats along the surface of different cell types. So the apolipoproteins are a very important player in cardiovascular function, and they're not just kind of passive transport detergent molecules. They actually have their own personalities and their own distinctive influence on vascular dynamics. So if we start talking about apolipoprotein A or B or E, we're talking about not just the fats that they transport, but also the message that they in fact bring by themselves as these bioactive transport proteins. So when Dr. Scott Grundy is talking about atherogenic dyslipidemia associated with metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance, he's saying that these apolipoprotein B particles are manifest at higher levels during states of hyperinsulinemia, and they then transport various types of fats that include LDL remnants and small atherogenic LDL particles to the artery wall, where they can participate then in what's called cardiometabolic syndrome. Now, cardiometabolic syndrome is a fairly new term that tries to define how people who do not have the traditional risk factors for cardiovascular disease, such as hypertension or elevated levels of cholesterol or smokers or diabetics, may still be at significant risk to cardiovascular disease because they have this underlying kind of smoldering metabolic syndrome hyperinsulinemia that alters their apolipoprotein distribution and alters the delivery of certain messages to their vascular cells, their vascular wall cells, and their vascular endothelium. So metabolic syndrome and preventive cardiology are working closely together to try to understand this connection. In fact, there's a very nice review paper authored by Nathan Wong on this topic that appeared in Metabolic Syndrome and Related Disorders Journal, Volume 4, page 233 in 2006. It really discusses the importance for doing an assessment in cardiology of the presence of insulin resistance hyperinsulinemia so that you can pick up this cholesterol-independent component of risk to cardiovascular disease. In this article, they go on to suggest that a great percentage of people that die by sudden coronary events and did not have the traditional precedent risk factors to heart disease were those who really carried with them this metabolic syndrome hyperinsulinemia that put them at risk unknown to them. And unless you analyze this risk, you are not likely to see it. This is a little bit like the example of blood pressure and stroke. No one really understood the correlation between elevated blood pressure and stroke risk until the development of the sphygmomanometer, the blood pressure measuring cuff, which then was able to actually measure relative risk and show an association between elevated blood pressure and stroke risk. By the same token, if you're not measuring these cardiometabolic risk factors that I've described, such as elevated fasting triglycerides, reduced HDL, the blood pressure changes, body mass changes with central adiposity and a waist-to-hip increase, and even the apolipoprotein alteration that I'm now describing, that you're not likely to understand that patient is at risk. So what has emerged is the ApoB to ApoA1 ratio is a strong new risk factor for cardiovascular disease and a target then for therapy that's associated with the risk to metabolic syndrome and hyperinsulinemia. I'm now quoting from the Journal of Internal Medicine, Volume 259, page 493 in 2006, a very nice review paper by Waldius and Junger, who have been principal researchers in this field for some time. What is apolipoprotein A1? If apolipoprotein B transports the atherogenic dense LDL particles and remnants of LDL, the ApoA1 is the converse. It transports the backbone of what we call the HDL particle. HDL is involved with cholesterol efflux from the artery wall. It's like an unloaded flatbed truck that arrives at the cell wall. The apolipoprotein binds to the membrane of that receptor site and then is involved with loading up the flatbed truck with cholesterol by effluxing it out of the cell and then taking it through the bloodstream to a place where it can be metabolized, converted into bile acids, and ultimately excreted in the bile or made up as part of bile as the cholesterol esters. So the ApoA1 is a important apolipoprotein for cholesterol efflux, whereas apolipoprotein B is associated with delivery of cholesterol and lipids to the cell, so it's influx. So you want your apolipoprotein B level to be low because you don't want to deliver too much lipid to the cell itself, and you'd like your apolipoprotein A1 level to be high, and that is you have more available flatbed trucks to efflux the cholesterol out of the cell. Now, when I say A1, I want you to understand that's capital A-1. We're not talking about apolipoprotein little a. Little a is a subtype, and that is a atherogenic apolipoprotein as associated with apo capital A1, which is an anti-atherogenic lipoprotein. So the ratio of ApoB to ApoA1, you would like to go down, right? You'd like it to be low. And when I say low, I would suggest that number means less than or equal to 0.7. The lower the number, the better. So as your number goes from 0.7 to 0.8, that is increasing atherogenic risk associated with cardiometabolic syndrome. I would go on to suggest that based on Dr. Kraft's and others' work, that that would also suggest increased risk to cognitive decline and Alzheimer's plaque and other kinds of disinsulinism that is associated with altered neurological function, central neurological function. So we shouldn't just focus solely on the effect of an altered ApoB to ApoA1 ratio as being cardiometabolic. We should also think of it in terms of neurometabolic as well. Now, if we were to compare apolipoprotein B A1 ratios, in subjects with versus those without metabolic syndrome, you might ask, is there a difference? Can you differentiate the two based upon their ratios? And as I've said, there's now very strong evidence that the ApoB to ApoA1 ratio predicts cardiovascular risk factor better than any of the cholesterol indices. That would be cholesterol HDL ratio, for instance, or LDL levels. In this more recent study that I'm quoting from, which is found in the American Journal of Cardiology, volume 98, page 1369 in 2006, the investigators wanted to evaluate the ApoB to ApoA1 ratio related to metabolic syndrome. They analyzed 2,964 subjects, mean age 48 years, about 1,500 men and 1,450 women from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey 3, with apolipoprotein data that were evaluated for metabolic syndrome and its components. The metabolic syndrome was defined, as you know, according to the criteria of the National Cholesterol Education Program Adult Treatment Panel 3. That was the first time this was actually listed as part of the NIH guidelines, and also it's now listed in the International Diabetes Federation publications. The mean values of the ApoB to ApoA1 ratio with subjects with and without the metabolic syndrome were compared, and overall the median distribution of the ApoB to ApoA1 ratio was significantly greater in subjects with the ATCP3 metabolic syndrome than those without. And in fact, the difference was at the P less than 0.0001 significant. So highly significant difference in differentiating between those with metabolic syndrome versus those without. So in conclusion, this particular study finds that the ApoB to ApoA1 ratio is strongly associated with the presence of metabolic syndrome and can be used as a early stage interventional risk factor marker for what they call cardiometabolic syndrome, but we might also call it neurometabolic syndrome because of the emerging connection between hyperinsulinemia and neurological dysfunction. Now, when you start looking a little bit more in depth at what we know about ApoB and ApoA1, it really is a very fascinating emergence of the story. Just to review for you the fact that over the last three decades, it's been recognized that a high level of total blood cholesterol, particularly in the form of LDL cholesterol, is a major risk factor for developing coronary heart disease. However, as we start to look at more recent research, it's expanded our understanding of lipoprotein functions and metabolism, and a considerable portion of patients with atherosclerotic disease have levels of LDL cholesterol and total cholesterol that are actually within the recommended range, and some patients who achieve significant LDL cholesterol reduction with lipid-lowering therapy still develop cardiovascular disease. So other lipid parameters associated with cardiovascular risk are these lipoprotein subfractions that are components of the lipoprotein particles that include protein and fat together. So we talk about apolipoprotein B existing actually in two forms, an ApoB48 and an ApoB100. ApoB48 is synthesized in the intestine where it's complex with dietary triglyceride and free cholesterol absorbed from the gut lumen to form chylomicron particles that are generally cleared postprandially very quickly out of the blood within the first few hours after eating. ApoB100, however, is synthesized in the liver and is present in LDL intermediate density lipoproteins and very low density lipoprotein particles. Only one ApoB molecule is present in each of the lipoprotein particles, and therefore the total ApoB value indicates the total number of potentially atherogenic lipoproteins. ApoB is essential for the binding of LDL particles to the LDL receptor, allowing cells to internalize LDL. An excess of ApoB-containing particles is the main trigger of the atherogenic process. Individuals with seemingly low or normal LDL cholesterol levels can still be at increased risk of cardiovascular events, and in these patients, the risk of cardiovascular events appears to be more closely related to the increased number of small, dense LDL particles, in addition to hypertriglyceridemia and low levels of the protective HDL cholesterol. This is a combination that we know as the atherogenic lipid triad, and it's associated with metabolic syndrome and hyperinsulinemia. Target levels for ApoB have now been included in a table on the treatment goals of the National Cholesterol Education Program ATP 3 guidelines. Patients with diabetes or the metabolic syndrome can have normal LDL cholesterol levels but possess aspects of atherogenic lipid profiles that are associated with a high ratio of the ApoB to ApoA1. As I said, ApoA1 acts as a cofactor for lecithin acetylcholesterol transferase, which is important in removing excess cholesterol from tissues and incorporating it into HDL for reverse transport to the liver. Furthermore, ApoA1 is the ligand for the ATP binding cassette protein, which is called the ABC protein, ABCA1, and hence is involved in the docking procedure by which excess cholesterol in peripheral cells is externalized to HDL for further reverse cholesterol transport, either directly or indirectly via LDL back to the liver for metabolism. HDL, as you know, exists as particles of different sizes, with HDL2 being the largest and containing the most lipid in its core and having the highest efflux capacity for cholesterol. And ApoA1 is a very strong predictor of HDL cholesterol-2 levels. So high levels of ApoA1, high levels of HDL2. So apolipoprotein little a, as contrasted to capital A1, is bound to LDL to form this apolipoprotein A, LPA, which shares 80% of its amino acid sequence with plasminogen and competitively binds the surface binding and activation of plasminogen. Elevated LP little a has been associated with arterial wall thickening, and high blood concentrations of apo little a have been suggested as risk factors for atherosclerosis. But in evaluating all the risk factors, it appears as if elevated ApoA1 is the most strongly associated with a decreased risk to cardiovascular disease, and elevation of apolipoprotein B is associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So the ApoB level was found to be the best predictor of the extent of cardiovascular disease after correction for age, as assessed by the number of stenotic arteries, and was the only statistically significant predictor of the presence of cardiovascular disease in patients without frank dyslipidemia. So that's why we keep saying that the ApoB to ApoA1 ratio is a very interesting prognostic marker for not just cardiometabolic syndrome, but also neurometabolic syndrome associated with hyperinsulinemia. There are a large number of prospective studies that have evaluated this association, including the AMORIS, A-M-O-R-I-S study, compared with subjects in the lowest quartile. Those in the highest quartile in this study for ApoB had almost a threefold increase in risk to cardiovascular disease. For the ApoB to ApoA1 ratio, the increase in risk was almost fourfold in men and threefold in women for those who had the highest quintile ratio of ApoB to ApoA1. So we're talking about significant increases in relative risk as defined by the ApoB to ApoA1 relative ratio. In multivariate analyses, high ApoB levels and the high ApoB to A1 ratio and low levels of ApoA1 were stronger predictors of risk than LDL cholesterol, total cholesterol, and triglyceride levels alone. Based on all of these findings, the ratio of ApoB to ApoA1, meaning the balance between potentially atherogenic cholesterol-rich ApoB-containing particles and the anti-atherogenic ApoA1-rich particles, is proposed as the best integrated measure of cardiac risk associated with lipoproteins and closely associates itself with metabolic syndrome and that of insulin resistance. Values of ApoB should be less than 1.2 grams per liter, and for ApoA1 should be greater than 1.2 grams per liter. And that's why I've said that the ratio for optimal function of the cardiovascular system should be a ratio of 0.7 or less between ApoB and ApoA1. Thus, in those at the greatest risk, a target ApoB level below 0.9 gram per liter is recommended regardless of gender. Regarding cutoff values for ApoBA1 ratio, as I said, we'd like it to be 0.7 or lower. So I think you can see that we're talking about a new emerging risk factor that not just ties itself solely to that of cardiometabolic risk, but also to the relative risk to neurologic problems, as will be described in much greater detail by our clinician of the month, Dr. Jay Lombard, a neurologist and a psychiatrist who really helps us to understand this broad connection in the web, the functional web, between hyperinsulinemia, inflammation, and other risk factors that are associated with neurodegenerative diseases. So I'd like to disclose, so that we've all come to the same point here at the end of this discussion, that there are a variety of surrogate markers that are used clinically for evaluating the presence of hyperinsulinemia, such as the elevated triglyceride HDL ratio, elevated waist to hip ratio, elevated waist, elevated percent body fat, increased uric acid, increased blood pressure, increased high sensitivity CRP, and increased marginal elevations of percent glycosylated hemoglobin or hemoglobin A1C. But if we add to that the relative evaluation of ApoB to ApoA1 ratio, we might now form a panel of evaluative tools that really is helpful in looking much earlier at the potential risk to not just diabetes and cardiovascular disease, but also neurodegenerative problems that are associated with hyperinsulinemia and insulin resistance and the deposition of beta amyloid plaque. We're going to discuss this now with our clinician of the month, Dr. Jay Lombard.
Well, here we are back again to what is for all of us our favorite part of Functional Medicine Update, our clinician slash researcher of the month component of the issue. And this month I'm very privileged to have a longstanding friend calling and a person that I have tremendous respect for and admiration professionally, Dr. Jay Lombard. Dr. Lombard is the chief of neurology at Bronx Lebanon Hospital and is an assistant clinical professor of neurology at Cornell Medical School. He's both dual boarded in psychiatry and neurology and has been a friend and colleague really for more than 25 years since we first met in Rhinebeck, New York at the Omega Institute back about that period of time ago. And Jay's career has really spanned a tremendous swath of clinical experience. He's managed some of the sickest of the sick and been able to bring a tremendous vision and integration of various practice management and techniques into his skill set, and I think really has framed for many of us the model of what integrative, open-minded, lifelong learning in medicine really means. So, Jay, it's wonderful to have you as a clinician of the month in Functional Medicine Update. And, you know, you call yourself a behavioral neurologist, and I think that's a very interesting term. So for the sake of our listeners, could you help us understand what that term means?
Well, behavioral neurology is, I think, first and foremost, the recognition that many disorders that we encounter in our daily lives and clinical practice have, in many ways, a direct relationship with our brains and our moods and our emotional states. And in terms of the specifics of what a behavioral neurologist is, my practice and other neurologists who practice this way are focused on disorders like autism and attention deficit disorder on one extreme of the lifespan, and then Alzheimer's and dementias and cognitive problems on the other. But it's also, I think, a recognition about how critical emotional states are to our overall physiology as well.
I think that's a very interesting and important part of this whole mind-body connection. You know, I think there's still, believe it or not, in the 21st century, people who separate the mind from the body and try to dissect each component as if they were separate channels or silos of non-interacting function. And certainly from the functional medicine perspective and from your practice and the way you've both treated patients and been a teacher, there is a very significant integration marriage between the two that it seems, as I've listened to you, can't separate behavior from neurological function. And so it's a chicken and egg argument.
That's right. And there's probably a top-down and a bottom-up approach. That is that the appreciation that mood states and emotional states can clearly affect our physiology. And this is something that just recently I have spoken to many physicians about this concept of neurocardiology and neuroimmunology, in which there is very strong data, both epidemiological as well as physiological, on how alterations in brain states increase vulnerability to specific disorders. But I think the other piece of that, which is clearly as important, is the bottom-up approach, which is how systemic variables, whether it's dysbiosis or immune dysregulation, affects mood and cognition. So it's a reciprocal, interdependent relationship between brain-body function that goes bidirectionally.
You know, your books have been very instrumental in my learning in this field. Your Brain Wellness Plan, which was, I think, your first book by Kensington Press, and more recently your Balance Your Brain, a Wiley book. And they talk really about this behavioral neurology from a perspective that the average reader can understand. But I know that in your research and in your practice, you've been involved with brain imaging and neuropsychopharmacology, and many of your patients that you deal with at the neurology component at Bronx Lebanon Hospital are very seriously ill. So it sounds like you've had the opportunity professionally to cover the whole waterfront. Is this an advantage to you, do you believe, in bringing perspective to manage problems?
I certainly hope so. I mean, it's something that one can never fully feel on top of because of the complexities of these relationships. And the learning curve is continuous. I mean, there's never a day that goes by in which some unique aspect about this relationship reveals itself in some unexpected ways. So it's something, I mean, you know, choosing neurology as a profession in many ways is a blessing and a curse, because the blessing is that you never fully can understand exactly what's happening, and that's exciting, but also can be terrifying when you appreciate the magnitude of those effects.
From my definition, you're really kind of in the pinnacle of practicing a functional neurology. I think that's further supported by the reviews that you've had when you've been an instructor at the neurology module from the Institute for Functional Medicine. And in those presentations you've made, you've often talked a little bit about case histories and experience you've had. Could you share with us the kind of patients that you see, or maybe through some of the eyes of your patients, some of the problems that you've encountered that describe how we would contextualize behavioral neurology?
Okay, well, I think you can choose any number of examples of this relationship, and something that I think you may find quite interesting, Jeff, specifically the area of research that I'm pursuing currently, which is the recognition of angiotensin receptors in the brain. For those of listeners who are familiar with angiotensin, it's, you know, clearly something that cardiologists pay attention to because of its regulation of blood pressure, and it has a diverse effect on renal function in terms of increasing sodium and water resorption. It increases vasoconstriction. It increases catecholamine production, particularly norepinephrine, and has just this very ubiquitous effect across many different organ systems, and not been thought about as being critical in brain function. But this is a gross oversight, I think, on the part of both researchers and clinicians, because, in fact, angiotensin has specific effects in the brain and is involved in the stress response, specifically what happens during periods of time when people are in a fight-or-flight situation or in depression. And it also has applicability for what I believe are a number of neurodevelopmental disorders like autism. So looking at this key effector molecule, if you will, angiotensin, and ways that it's implicated in both systemic disorders and also in neurological disorders, I think provides us with a quite unique opportunity and window into understanding how to modulate this hormone, both for body problems, which is already being done through specific types of compounds like the ACE inhibitors and the angiotensin receptor blockers, but also has a unique effect on mood and modulating anxiety. And what's particularly interesting about angiotensin is that it's directly influenced by vitamin D levels. And here's something that I think really caught my eye in terms of looking at something nutritional and something that could be easily assessed, which has been overlooked. And that is that vitamin D levels are inversely proportional to angiotensin. The lower a patient's vitamin D levels are, the higher angiotensin and particularly plasma renin levels are. And conversely, if we administer vitamin D, let's say to either a human or to an animal, we can lower angiotensin and plasma renin. And this has implications for many, many disorders, not just cardiac diseases in which vitamin D levels have been demonstrated to be lower in patients with congestive heart failure, for instance, but also vitamin D levels are lower in stroke patients and in MS patients. And recently we've covered, we think, some very significant abnormalities in vitamin D in autism as well. So it's a very exciting area which integrates both functional medicine as well as mind-body medicine.
That's a very interesting observation that I was unaware of. A number of years ago, I had the chance to present at Dr. Mark Houston's conference on hypertension at Vanderbilt University Medical School, and one of the co-presenters there was a gentleman who had been researching for 20 years angiotensin and was talking about angiotensin receptor blockers and angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor drugs as being anti-aging drugs because he felt that angiotensin was one of the critical factors associated with accelerated biological aging of the heart, vasculature, and brain. And so he was showing how low-dose use of these ARBs and ACE inhibitors actually could be seen from animal studies as preventing age-related deterioration. So what's the story from your perspective on these pharmaceuticals that have been used to modulate angiotensin?
There are clearly animal studies in which if you administer particularly the angiotensin receptor blocking agents to animals prior to inducing a very traumatic type of stimulus to them, that you can block a lot of the stress response. And this is opening the door to looking at possibly using these agents for treating stress-related disorders like post-traumatic stress or other disorders that you would normally would not think of using an ARB for. But, you know, obviously the concern, I think, with ARB use particularly is using them for purposes beyond what they're intended to be used for, and specifically what it is that's gone awry in our physiology that has created this disturbance in angiotensin to begin with. And I think that's where the vitamin D story is quite interesting. If we look further downstream at how angiotensin modulates a variety of pathophysiological processes, particularly interesting is a matrix protein that's highly expressed in blood vessels called thrombospondin. And thrombospondin is an atherogenic protein that is highly upregulated during ischemic events, whether it's acute ischemic events or chronic ischemic events. And what happens once thrombospondin is activated, it sets into motion a cascade that actually works particularly on transforming growth factor and other pro-inflammatory cytokines. And what's interesting about this whole cascade is that the ARB drugs like losartan and other drugs actually are thrombospondin inhibitors. That is, that they can block this immune response by virtue of downregulating thrombospondin. So they have an effect that is both anti-inflammatory and anti-ischemic. But I think, again, that the relationship of vitamin D particularly to the ARBs, in that perhaps one wonders if vitamin D is an endogenous ARB acting agent, and that's something that I think we should be looking at.
I have noticed that there are a couple of nutraceuticals that have been developed and recently marketed to be natural ACE inhibitors that are specific peptides of fish protein hydrolysate and casein hydrolysate. Do you have any clinical experience or thoughts about those?
The Bonita, right?
Bonita peptide.
Mm-hmm. Right. I haven't actually. I've actually seen some of the data. You know, I've not actually looked at those, but that would be an interesting compound to study to see if some of these anti-anxiety and anti-inflammatory effects that one sees with vitamin D would also be seen with the Bonita peptides. And I could tell you just empirically that I have seen many patients who are diagnosed with, you know, these very low vitamin D levels do quite well from a behavioral neurology perspective with vitamin D supplementation. And again, I think the mechanism of action here is that it's acting as an endogenous angiotensin receptor blocker. But I don't know whether the Bonita peptides have that same effect or not.
You know, it's very interesting to listen to you over the years because you can bring so many different disciplines into your presentations and into your perspective. So people listening might say, well, geez, I wonder what kind of training that Dr. Lombard had. If a person is on the path to gain mastery in this area, could you share with us the training and postgraduate education that prepared you with this perspective?
Well, I think first and foremost, one should go to as many Jeff Bland seminars as possible. I mean that sincerely. You are singly the one person that allowed me to open my eyes to these very, very beautiful molecular events that are occurring beyond the surface of how we think of physiology and pathophysiology and pharmacology, to always ask, what's the next layer? You know, it's like peeling the onion. So you taught me as the, I'll call you the first onion peeler, Jeff. And, you know, I used that onion peeling approach to my psychiatry training and to my neurology training, in that any disorder that I would look at, whether it was schizophrenia or depression or bipolar disease, Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, to keep asking the question, okay, this is what we know. What is it that's the next layer below that that is creating that disturbance, and so on and so on. And you end up at a very molecular level looking predominantly intracellularly at mitochondrial energetics, and specifically how all this relates to not just the mitochondria, but also peroxisomes, which I think is another area that we're bound to hear a lot more about in regards to its anti-inflammatory effects and cell survival, and the relationship of peroxisomes to mitochondrial function. But this idea that the mitochondria are so instrumental in increasing vulnerability to disease by an energetic phenomena was something that I think you saw a long, long time ago and has come to fruition amongst many research scientists across a diverse span of disciplines, whether it's cardiology or neurology or psychiatry. And I think that, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction here, that in traditional medicine, we all look at our separate silos, and the cardiologists don't really think about talking to neurologists or to the immunologists. And to really, really get to the bottom of the fundamental elements of disease, as well as the introduction of positive health phenomena, we have to break down those walls and have each of the disciplines talk to each other and realize that we're talking the same language here. Just as one example, I'll be talking coming up in 07, and I had to kind of brush up on my immunology because it's not something that I'm as familiar with as I am with the literature in neurology and psychiatry. And I was looking at how specifically T cells, when activated, what kind of biochemical cascade occurs as a result of T cell activation when it's actually responding to an antigen. And that cascade is identical to the cascade that occurs when a neuronal cell is depolarized. It's identical. That is that there is this depolarization of the neuron with influx of calcium, activation of an acetyl triphosphate, extravasation of calcium from the endoplasmic reticulum, and activation of these pro-inflammatory cytokines like TGF and caspases and all of those immunogenic enzymes. Identical. So here you have this biochemical pathway in immunology, which is completely the same as the biochemical cascade that occurs when a neuronal cell is being excessively depolarized and perhaps going into an apoptotic mode. And that really struck me as, wow, this is like a string theory. So these identical modes of operation. But if you think about it, it makes sense. I mean, nature is redundant. Nature likes to use what works, and it's parsimonious in its execution of biochemical pathways.
Well, you've raised a very interesting topic that I know is on the minds of a lot of people who have kind of even had cursory review of the recent neurology literature, and that's the association between certain neurodegenerative problems and what's called neuronal hyperexcitation, or NMDA, excitation. Can you tell us a little bit, because I know you've spoken very eloquently and I think very beautifully, as to how that whole pathway can be triggered by environmental agents, the NMDA excitotoxic pathway?
Sure, and that's something that has really expanded in the last 10 years in terms of its appreciation for the involvement of excitotoxic pathways in a variety of neurological problems, not just Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, but also in MS, in ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, diabetic neuropathies, epilepsy, bipolar disease, autism. I mean, there's these, what I call the final common pathways of excess excitatory NMDA pathways in which glutamate is upregulated. That occurs, you know, there are many roads that lead to Rome, but it occurs in one of the most interesting ways is through, particularly through the arachidonic acid pathway. That is that when we have a diet that is high in the omega-6 arachidonic acid content, this leads to a excess expression of NMDA receptors because arachidonic acid blocks glutamate reuptake. So when glutamate is found in high concentrations in the synapse, it binds to the NMDA receptor and sets into motion these pro-apoptotic or neuroinflammatory pathways that appear to be linked to a variety of neurological diseases. And one may say, well, you know, how does that make sense? Because MS is very different than ALS, which is true. But the explanation is that the phenotype is different because the disease process is occurring in different types of tissue, but the biochemical processes may be similar. So, for instance, bipolar disease and epilepsy are very different. Epilepsy is obviously a seizure disorder. Bipolar disease is not a seizure disorder, but these glutamate pathways are disturbed in such a way that they are upregulated in both diseases, but depending on which area of the brain that abnormal expression is reflected will give you the particular phenotype of the disorder.
So when we look at two molecules that have gotten in the news quite a bit in connect them to this NMDA glutamate excitation, one of which is MSG and the other is L-glutamine. Can you give us your top line thoughts about each of those? There are people who are very concerned about MSG relative to this neurohyperexcitation, and there's those who would say that if you supplement with L-glutamine, you stimulate that same pathway.
Right. Okay. So this next question comes up a lot in the seminars about concern about creating a excess glutamate state in patients inadvertently by glutamine administration. There's really no data to support that that's the case at all for several reasons. First of all, glutamine is used both for the synthesis of GABA and glutamate. In fact, those two neurotransmitters, which are diametrically opposed in regards to their physiological function, are in many ways mirror images of each other, that glutamate is used as the immediate precursor for GABA, which is kind of interesting that the poison, if you will, and the cure are within the same metabolic pathway. So I think in regards to glutamine specifically, there is no concern in my mind that giving glutamine to patients can theoretically increase glutamate in the brain. The MSG story, I think, is something that more complicated from what I actually have read, which is some data that they've tried to actually confirm if giving MSG exogenously would increase glutamate receptors through these kind of in vitro analyses of brains of rats, for instance. And they were not able to actually activate glutamate receptors through MSG administration. So that conclusion from that particular study was that MSG did not have a particular bearing on brain glutamate receptors. Now, I'm not sure if I believe that, but that's just what the data currently demonstrates. I think that one of the points to keep in mind here, and this is one of the difficulties in doing any kind of neurological research, is the blood-brain barrier. We have this barrier particularly to prevent these kinds of problems. That is, if MSG were able to, through oral ingestion, penetrate the blood-brain barrier, then I think it's a different game than if it's not able to enter the blood-brain barrier. And same thing may be true to a lesser extent through L-glutamine. And it's also true, by the way, with GABA administration, that on the therapeutic end, the same limitations apply, which is that GABA does not cross the blood-brain barrier very well. So I think that there's this concept of blood-brain barrier or neurologically privileged biochemical milieu that makes these questions a little bit less of a concern than one would have at first glance.
You know, you've raised a very interesting point that I actually had never thought about until you mentioned it, and that has to do with the gut, which some call, as we interviewed Dr. Gerson several years ago, the second brain, because it shares so many of the putative messaging compounds that the brain produces as neuroregulators. And so the gut doesn't really have the barrier in terms of the blood-brain barrier as that kind of compartmentalization that the brain itself has. So is it possible that some of the things that we think are neuroactive are really operating through gut signaling phenomena?
I think there's no question that there is signaling that takes place between peripheral biochemical factors and neurological factors, particularly as it relates to gut peptides like CCK and secretin and other gut peptides that has effects in changing brain signaling without directly crossing the blood-brain barrier. So I think that the subtext of your question is, I think, if I'm reading this properly, is that yes, it may be true that MSG does not cross the blood-brain barrier or that the glutamine or oral GABA doesn't, but is it possible that signals can be communicated through some biochemical cascade indirectly without those molecules directly crossing the blood-brain barrier? And I think that, you know, the answer is we don't know, but certainly in my mind makes sense. And to add another level of complexity to this is that the blood-brain barrier itself is disturbed in many disease processes. For instance, in MS, for example, one of the biggest problems in MS is that the blood-brain barrier is more porous than it is in patients, particularly with disease exacerbations, than in people who don't have MS. So all bets are off in regards to making the, I hate to contradict myself here because that's probably what some of your listeners are thinking right now, but I think that the blood-brain barrier itself is disturbed by many systemic disease processes that changes the equation in regards to perhaps our thinking that something is not getting across the blood-brain barrier. I hate to say this, but there's really no easy answers to some of the questions that you're bringing up, and many people like to have simple yes or no answers or responses to these kinds of questions, but there are more we don't knows in the field of neurology and psychiatry than there are yes, definitely, or no, definitely. And that's, again, the blessing and curse of being in this field of medicine.
I know you've talked a little bit about the serotonergic pathways and how the gut secretes, I think, nearly two-thirds of the whole body serotonin. People have asked the question, well, what happens if you do gastric bypass for morbid obesity and you put to rest your gut? Are you altering serotonergic peripheral metabolism in such a way that it has a whole body effect? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I have some empirical observations, which is that many people that I, patients of mine who've undergone gastric bypass have done really horribly after surgery. And one can certainly pose it that by taking away that reservoir of not just serotonergic neurotransmission, but a huge amount of different gastrointestinal hormones and peptides that you've disrupted their milieu, has consequences of one's health that we don't even know about yet. So just on an empirical observation, many of my patients actually have gotten more sick post-gastric bypass. One wonders if that's the mechanism of action of why that's happened.
I want to go back and pick up something you said earlier about vitamin D. I've recently been following, you know, you've raised a very interesting point that I actually had never thought about until you mentioned it, and that has to do with the gut, which some call, as we interviewed Dr. Gerson several years ago, the second brain, because it shares so many of the putative messaging compounds that the brain produces as neuroregulators. And so the gut doesn't really have the barrier in terms of the blood-brain barrier as that kind of compartmentalization that the brain itself has. So is it possible that some of the things that we think are neuroactive are really operating through gut signaling phenomena?
I think there's no question that there is signaling that takes place between peripheral biochemical factors and neurological factors, particularly as it relates to gut peptides like CCK and secretin and other gut peptides that has effects in changing brain signaling without directly crossing the blood-brain barrier. So I think that the subtext of your question is, I think, if I'm reading this properly, is that yes, it may be true that MSG does not cross the blood-brain barrier or that the glutamine or oral GABA doesn't, but is it possible that signals can be communicated through some biochemical cascade indirectly without those molecules directly crossing the blood-brain barrier? And I think that, you know, the answer is we don't know, but certainly in my mind makes sense. And to add another level of complexity to this is that the blood-brain barrier itself is disturbed in many disease processes. For instance, in MS, for example, one of the biggest problems in MS is that the blood-brain barrier is more porous than it is in patients, particularly with disease exacerbations, than in people who don't have MS. So all bets are off in regards to making the, and I hate to contradict myself here because that's probably what some of your listeners are thinking right now, but I think that the blood-brain barrier itself is disturbed by many systemic disease processes that changes the equation in regards to perhaps our thinking that something is not getting across the blood-brain barrier. I hate to say this, but there's really no easy answers to some of the questions that you're bringing up, and many people like to have simple yes or no answers or responses to these kinds of questions, but there are more we don't knows in the field of neurology and psychiatry than there are yes, definitely, or no, definitely. And that's, again, the blessing and curse of being in this field of medicine.
I know you've talked a little bit about the serotonergic pathways and how the gut secretes, I think, nearly two-thirds of the whole body serotonin. People have asked the question, well, what happens if you do gastric bypass for morbid obesity and you put to rest your gut? Are you altering serotonergic peripheral metabolism in such a way that it has a whole body effect? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I have some empirical observations, which is that many people that I, patients of mine who've undergone gastric bypass have done really horribly after surgery. And one can certainly pose it that by taking away that reservoir of not just serotonergic neurotransmission, but a huge amount of different gastrointestinal hormones and peptides that you've disrupted their milieu has consequences of one's health that we don't even know about yet. So just on an empirical observation, many of my patients actually have gotten more sick post-gastric bypass. One wonders if that's the mechanism of action of why that's happened.
I want to go back and pick up something you said earlier about vitamin D. I've recently been following a weblog that has been discussing the potential that vitamin D excess may have very serious adverse effects and that people should be managed to have low vitamin D levels because vitamin D has a series of adverse triggering effects on the neuroimmune system. Have you followed this discussion at all? Because it seems to be picking up a head of steam that there's this contrarian view about vitamin D, which I personally don't share, but I just wonder if you have had a chance to hear about it.
Well, I haven't seen that literature, but I think that one of the things to keep in mind with all of functional medicine in general, but it is very much this applies specifically to neurology and psychiatry when we do any kind of intervention, whether it's pharmacological or nutraceutical, is that it's the, I call it the Goldilocks principle, which is that it can't be a little too cold or a little bit too hot. It has to be just the right temperature. And I think that concept applies to vitamin D administration. That is that low vitamin D, in my mind, has many pathophysiological consequences as it relates to neurology and psychiatry particularly. And as we mentioned earlier, relates to its effects on angiotensin and also on other pathways, including IL-10, which we didn't discuss earlier, and also its effects on brain serotonin receptors. But one can imagine that there's probably issues with high vitamin D in that excess vitamin D, I mean, just from purely medical school 101 lecture, can in some cases raise calcium and make patients hypercalcemic. And that certainly is a serious consequence without going into even more sophisticated explanations about vitamin D toxicosis. But I think beyond just that obvious concern about vitamin D intoxication is the anti-inflammatory effects of vitamin D that in high doses may predispose to one's vulnerability for diseases related to immune suppression. So I think that you have to look at this as a dose range concept, not just for vitamin D, but for anything that we do exogenously, patients at a biochemical level.
Yeah, I think that's a very good watchword. And I think Mike Hollick and Colleen Hayes, who have talked more about the trying to get patients up into the 40 to 50 nanograms per ml, 25 hydroxy vitamin D level, and keep them in that range is a very good watchword rather than trying to say more is better.
Absolutely.
Could you tell us a little bit about your experience in behavioral neurology with natural products? You know that we hear a lot of very remarkable claims about certain botanical medicines and so forth. Obviously, ginkgo biloba has gotten a huge amount of press, but there are many others, huperzine and others. Can you give us a sense from your experience where some of this really weighs out?
Well, you mentioned huperzine, and I think huperzine is, in my mind, going to be one of the most phenomenal stories in natural medicine in the next several years, if it's not already caught steam, because huperzine, as many people know, is a natural compound that was used in China as a botanical from Chinese club moss. Years back, the Mayo Clinic discovered that huperzine possessed an effect which enhanced brain acetylcholine levels by blocking an enzyme known as acetylcholine esterase, and began studying it for Alzheimer's disease. And now the NIH is involved in some large-scale phase 2 studies with huperzine for Alzheimer's, and the preliminary data looks very, very promising. The other effect on huperzine, in addition to its effects as an acetylcholine agonist for the brain, is that it also acts as an NMDA antagonist. So it has an effect on upregulating acetylcholine and downregulating glutamate. So it has an effect that's beyond its effect on just cognition. And this area, by the way, just as an aside here, which I think is also very interesting, there's a researcher not too far from where I practice at North Shore Medical Center by the name of Dr. Pavlov, and I think he may actually be related to the original Pavlov, who's done some very eloquent research on that central cholinergic mechanisms have an anti-inflammatory effect, that by stimulating central acetylcholine neurotransmission, one can, via the vagal nerve, decrease production of tumor necrosis factor and other pro-inflammatory cytokines. So it's another area that I think is emerging as one of these surprise findings of how the brain and the immune system are communicating indirectly through these very complex signaling mechanisms. So I think huperzine is one example there. To answer your question in a hopefully not too circuitous way, Jeff, that there are tons of compounds that surprise me in terms of their efficacy. And I think that's interesting in neurology and psychiatry is that the effects are not subtle. When you have an effect on something, when you take an autistic child, for instance, or you take an Alzheimer's patient or a Parkinson's patient, and you do an intervention, the effects are very obvious. There are no gray areas here, but people either do a lot better or they don't have an effect. So when one challenges a patient with an intervention, whether it's pharmaceutical or nutraceutical, their report and their response is the harshest critic that one can have for a treatment. And I tell patients this exactly. I said, you know, the harshest critic of a treatment is the response that you have. Nothing is more objective than how you feel after we do something by taking something to help you with a problem.
I'd like to do a little bit of a soundbite with you here and just get your quick vignette on each of these natural products from your experience. And that is, let's go to ginkgo biloba with memory. What's your experience?
Mixed. I think that there are patients that have had benefit and there are patients who haven't had benefit. The patients who I've seen benefit with reported it in increasing attentional mechanisms, and I've seen it helped in patients who have microvascular ischemic disease. I've not seen much benefit in Alzheimer's disease.
St. John's wort and depression.
I think it's an effective herb for depression. I have used it for mild to moderate depression. I've been reluctant to use it in more severe types of depression, but I think for this dysthymic disorder, which is a sort of a chronic low-grade depression, I find that it's at least moderately effective as a typical SSRI or other traditional antidepressant drug.
Valerian and sleep.
I found it not effective.
B12 and folate for dysphoria and mild depression.
I have found methylfolate helpful for depression. I think that the distinction between methylfolate and folic acid is that the methylfolate is a preferred form to cross the blood-brain barrier, and I have seen definite effects, not just in depression, but also in ADHD patients as well with methylfolate.
Ginseng and stress-related phenomena.
It's a tough one. I've not been overly satisfied with my patients with ginseng. I actually looked at ginseng particularly for ADHD because it has some effects on dopamine receptors as a dopamine agonist, but I know that I'm certainly not a ginseng expert, and what I've learned is that there are many different types of ginseng, red ginseng and white ginseng, and it's for cold versus hot conditions, and I think that I would defer to my acupuncturist and Chinese herbal medicine doc to give better opinions on ginseng in this area.
Any botanical medicines that you found that are helpful in the area of stress-related dysfunction?
I think passion flower is one of my favorite herbal treatments because I think that we need to pay attention to sleep hygiene as a key element. I think sleep is the single best anti-inflammatory agent known to man, better than Motrin, better than Advil, better than any non-steroidal for that matter, is just ensuring proper sleep. I think that we as clinicians do not understand or appreciate sleep and its critical effects in acting as an anti-inflammatory agent, and anything that we can do to restore patients to a proper sleep can have an effect not just on their mental status but also on their physical well-being. And passion flower is certainly one of the things that I have found extremely effective to help patients with sleep.
We have just a couple minutes left. I'd like to at least touch upon something you said earlier, which I think is a emerging recognition of importance, and that's insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, and its relationship to dementia. I know you've had quite a bit of insight into that. Can you share some thoughts with us?
How much time do we have left? I mean, this is, I think, one of the most phenomenally interesting areas of medicine emerging, which is that insulin resistance is a key factor not just in one's risk of developing dementia, but a number of neurological, psychiatric, and systemic diseases, including cardiovascular disease. So beyond just the spectrum of diabetes, insulin resistance is such a fundamental disturbance in a pathway that leads to these very catastrophic disorders. So in regard to Alzheimer's disease, particularly, both Susan DeLamonte at Brown University and Dennis Selko at Mass General, who are both very esteemed Alzheimer's researchers, have done a lot of the groundbreaking basic science work on detecting that insulin resistance is indeed a critical pathological disturbance in dementia. This is supported by epidemiological data that patients who are diabetic or pre-diabetic have a greater risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, and anything that we can do for our patients to improve insulin resistance, whether it be physical exercise or nutraceuticals or even the PAR agents such as the omega-3 fatty acids, which have an effect on peroxisome proliferative activator proteins, have effects as anti-inflammatory agents and neuroprotective effects by virtue of improving insulin signaling.
Do you feel there's any difference between docosahexaenoic acid and eicosapentaenoic acid in that regard, or is it as long as you get the long-chain omega-3s?
I think the latter is probably true. I mean, I think there's more DHA expression in the brain than there is EPA. DHA is in high concentrations in both the retina and in synaptic vesicles. So as a neurologist, my interest is predominantly in DHA as a vital agent for neuroprotection. But I think that both EPA and DHA are certainly relevant because of their similarities in structure as their pluripotent role in metabolic pathways, both in inflammation, platelet aggregation, neurotransmission, and peroxisomal activation. So there are so many different ways that these compounds are found and that they're so vital to our healthy physiology that if I was on a deserted island and said, Dr. Lombardi, you know, you could take only one nutraceutical with you, you know, what would it be? It probably would be EPA and DHA for my patients.
Well, Jay, I can't tell you how much I've appreciated this. I know our listeners have as well. We've covered quite a wide domain here of discussion, and you've done it eloquently as always, and I think it's a testament to your background, the breadth of your understanding. So thank you very much. I know your patients have certainly valued from your years of training and perspective, and I know you treat everybody from the sickest of the sick to the walking wounded, and that requires many different skills and tools in your toolkit, and you certainly fit and exemplify what we call a functional neurologist. So thank you so much for being with us and continued good work, and we'll look forward to talking with you soon.
Thank you, Jeff. My pleasure.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis, LLC by Dr. Jeffrey Black. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.